Accession number 22924, Rule 3.
Mr. Wright, Rule 3.
Sorry, Rule 3. Yes. No, I was just mentioning that I drank all that sake myself. It was only a small bottle, but it was very pleasant while it lasted. But I mentioned this, but it does show that the sentries were an odd bunch. They could be very nasty. On the other hand, they could be very helpful, and they were very helpful in bringing things in for the hospital. And with this trading with the sentries, they would bring in a certain amount of drugs, particularly in the early days.
Did you ever get beaten by a guard?
No.
Or ill-treated in any way?
No.
Were there any other favours or good deeds that they did towards you?
Not towards me. And I should add, of course, in terms of that there were bad deeds they did. I mean, don't let me think, give the impression they were all marvellously kind. But I think if you kept a low profile, you usually got away without being beaten up. If you started kicking against the traces and then they could be nasty. But again, I've seen our own guard, Japanese guard, being beaten up, and it was part of their military discipline. So physical punishment was acceptable in the Japanese army. So they were not really treating us any differently from the way they would treat their own troops who misbehaved.
What kind of bad deeds did you have in mind?
Well, there was one very bad one, where a chap called Ken Barnett, who was also a volunteer officer, and in the same hut as me, and we had a Red Cross inspection, which was really rather farcical. I mean, this Red Cross man came as a Swiss. And as he was coming through our hut, this man, Barnett, shouted out, "We are being starved. Do something about it." And well, as soon as the Red Cross man had left our hut, a couple of guards came in and removed Ken Barnett, and we didn't see him for another week. And he was taken out and very badly beaten up, and starved. And he had to, as soon as he came back to camp, he had to have a week in the hospital to recover from his thing. So they could be very, very brutal if you upset them in any way of that sort. And there was one, I think it wasn't an officer, Japanese, I think it was a sergeant major, who used to drink quite a lot. I mean, he would come round the hut just looking for trouble. He would, again, you just had to keep a low profile. If he thought that you were not showing sufficient respect, he would, again, he would slap your face. But there were no, they did, which I think legitimately, they eventually found a radio set. Well, of course, they did, there were repercussions about that. And also, I think it's perhaps getting outside the province of this particular talk, but there were the attempts by the senior officers in 1942 to organise a mass escape, and they were, in fact, through, sounds very cloak and dagger, through a false bolt in the lorry that brought in our rations. We were sending messages out and get messages in, and this went on for quite a long time, and the Japanese did get on to that. And both in Champchipo and in the officers' camp, there was this communication with the British Army Aid Group in China. And the perpetrators were, in fact, arrested and tried and shot. But I think that this is perhaps legitimate on the part of the Japanese. I don't know international war, but there was certainly, within the prison camp, they were trying to organize a mass escape. And I think that this is perhaps a capital crime. I'm not sure.
Did you have anything to do with that communication or that attempt, the plans for escape?
No. But the young man I mentioned, John Harris, did, because each hut had to have one man who, when the lorry came in, undid the nut, or it was, to get the message. And John Harris was one in his particular hut. He was a man detailed with this job, and I think again this has had a very, very severe effect on him, because he must have had a terrible time over the next few weeks wondering if he wouldn't be taken out. Because if you were, in inverted commas, taken out, it always meant a great deal of torture.
Did you know about the Kempeitai?
Well, these were the ones who did the torturing of the people who went out, who were taken out in connection with them. And again, with the jumping back to the early escape when we were still in Chamtrypo, and there the Japanese, I think almost willy-nilly, took out about 10 people. I think they were people who were in the same hut or as the escapees, but they disappeared for about a week. And during that time, the Japanese told us that we had to, each person, officer and other rank, had to sign an undertaking that they would not escape. And of course, this is completely contrary to army discipline. And the general refused. And then the Japanese brought in these, brought back these 10 people who had been taken out after the escape, and they were in the appalling state of filth and emaciation, even after death. I think they had nothing to eat and no means of washing for the 10 days they were out, and they were brought back. And the Japanese said, well, if you don't sign, we will take you all out in turn and you will be treated in this way. And the poor general was, you know, in absolute quandary. And we had at that time a major in the gunner who was a member of the House of Lords and a lawyer, and he gave the general advice which he said could be accepted as official legal advice, that if the general ordered us to sign under duress, he would not be held responsible for any ill-doing after the war. And I've probably got it a little bit vague, but this was the crux of the thing as I understood it. So we were then told by the general it was okay to sign, and which we duly signed. And again, there were one or two who tried to hold out, but they were beaten up, and they all signed in the end. So they mixed up with the reasonable behaviour. There was some very, very bad behaviour by the Japanese.
Did you get any Allied bombing?
Yes, towards, not even towards the end, I suppose. It's difficult to say say when it started. I think we were still in, but yes, off and on there were high-level raids on mainly the two power companies and shipping. Well, we presume it was shipping. We couldn't see the harbour, but we could see where the bombs were dropping, and certainly the power companies were being bombed. And then one day there were a lot of low-level attacks, and a lot of and when there was an air raid, we had to go into our huts and lie down with our faces on the ground. And but there was a terrific amount of low-level, and one chap in the camp got quite badly wounded in the leg, and it was never known whether it was a Japanese shell that had come up and come down, or whether it was one of the American dive bombing things. They were letting off their guns, and like nobody's business. Yes, there were quite a few raids. Again, we had to be very careful not to upset the Japanese at that time, because they were very, very edgy, and we just sort of went and lay down on the floor and face to the ground.
Did you have any inkling as to what was happening to the Chinese population in Hong Kong?
Not during the battle, not during the time in the prison camp, no. But found out afterwards, of course.
Did you have much inkling as to what was going on in the events of the war?
Well, quite a bit, yes, because we had, we were getting a Chinese newspaper smuggled in. And not all the time, but quite a lot of the time. In fact, at one stage, the early stages, one of the things I decided to do to keep myself occupied, it was very important to keep yourself mentally occupied. And I learnt shorthand. because one of my sergeants was a shorthand teacher in civilian life, and three of us decided to learn shorthand. And I, we had a Chinese scholar who was translating the smuggled in Chinese paper. And he asked me one day my shorthand speed, and I said about 60 words a minute. And he said, well, you know, he could translate, instead of writing it all out in longhand, which he was doing, then he would lose his place. For several months after that, two of us used to find a corner, and Barnett would translate from the Chinese newspaper, and we would take it down in shorthand, and then go around the huts to read out the news while somebody was keeping cavey. And this was a great morale booster, because although the Japanese war, there were always great victories, but it was noted that there was a great victory at Midway. And then a month or 6 weeks after that, there was another great victory, but it was a few hundred miles nearer Japan, and one began to sort of have a feeling that things were not really going all that well. And it also published news of the Russian front correctly, and we could follow the Russian front news. And again, the Battle of not Sebastopol, another place began the battle.
Stalingrad.
Yeah, Stalingrad. You know, we were getting news of that, and we again got news when the Germans were withdrawing. So this again was a great morale booster to people to get this news in. If there was any really bad news about on the Allied side, the Japanese would bring in an English language newspaper. They brought one in, I remember, with the fall of Singapore, which a lot of people didn't believe, but I did. You know, one realised it was not a case of being relieved from Malaya, it was a case of three or four. I remember saying we've got to face up to 3 years of this now. And then when there was going to be Alexandria was being invested, and you know, what was this in 19 before Alame, wasn't it?
June 1942.
And again, they brought in a paper of that, and that was an interesting episode, because I was out, we had just go out gardening, and across the road where we grew tomatoes and lettuce and things like that, and we were having a 10-minute break, and Japanese sentry was, the three of us were sitting having a cigarette, actually, and Japanese sentry, the Japanese interpreter nearby, and looking straight ahead, he said, you know, don't worry, he said, you'll win in the end. And he was he'd worked in Cardiff, his shipping man worked in Cardiff before the war, and in fact, after the war, he got British papers, and he was a very good guy. There were two very good interpreters, two bastard interpreters, one of whom was hanged after the war as a war criminal. But this again was shows how different they were. You never knew how they were going to react. So we answering your question, yes, we knew pretty well what was going on. For a short time, there's a radio operating, and that would be the radio news would be interspersed with the news I would read from the Chinese paper. Ostensibly, it was from the Chinese paper. It was not meant to be generally known that there was a radio set operating. But after the landings in France, I think the Japanese then began bringing in a daily English language newspaper. Not every day, but now and again they did, and that used to publish the. But we were still getting a Chinese newspaper smuggled in. Though I'd stopped doing the shorthand, I was doing other jobs by this time. And then at the end of the war, the Japanese surrender, we got news of the surrender through a Japanese through a newspaper that was smuggled in. And the sentries used to bring them in. And when the camp commandant came in to do the counting on whatever day it was, August the 15th, I think it was, he was told that we understood the war was over, and there was no need to count us. And that the camp commandant said the war was not over. And so our senior British officer said, well, it is according to this newspaper, and showed him the newspaper. Well, it's not over in Hong Kong. And Simon White said, it's over And he said, I want to see Colonel Takanaga, who was the senior Japanese officer in charge of all the prison camps in Hong Kong. I want to see him this afternoon, and I want to have transport to take me to Stanley, to the civilian camp. And then I'll give the orders now, not you. And this duly happened. Very brave man, Simon White.
Was there any temptation to take revenge?
No. He was very sensible because he got his ferry, he went over, he made contact with the with Jimson, who was setting up a Hong Kong government, in Hong Kong, civilian government, but pending the arrival of the military forces. And but we were not allowed, on our own rules, we were not allowed out of the camp. It was continued to be run, but of course by our own people. But and official parties would go out to get rations, but there was no question of people going out of the camp and getting drunk and beating up the Japanese or anything like that. There was very, very strict control, and quite rightly so.
What about supplies coming in for prisoners from the outside, ex-prisoners?
Well, we got towards the end of April, end of August, the American Air Force came in and dropped a lot of parcels in the prison camp. But we, by that time, we were well organised, and I don't know where the food was coming from. That was not my concern, but we were certainly getting, you know, things like stew and so on as rations and meat. We were told to take it quietly because our stomachs weren't used to this rich food. But we were being still with basically rice, but we were getting meat and fish. And of course, we were then getting news from the outside. And I had two visitors at the camp gates that weren't allowed in. One was from my pre-war cook boy, who had, say, there were three of us lived together, myself and two grass widowers. And he came to see if we were all right. One of them was in Japan, on being transferred to Japan. And the other one was my ex-Chinese teacher, who came to see if I was all right. And they came once or twice during that fortnight's period after the Japanese surrender, before the fleet came in, when we were still confined to barracks. I was working in the camp hospital by that time, but I used to go and see them at the at the gate. In fact, and then subsequently, a day or two after the fleet came in, the senior civilian officers from Stanley came to our camp. And I think I mentioned earlier on, before we started this talk, that the plan was that when Hong Kong was relieved, the fighting troops would provide most of the odds and sods for the military administration. As there weren't any fighting troops, they came round the prison camp looking for volunteers, and I volunteered to stay on. I was unmarried, I was reasonably fit. And I remember the day I was moving out, my Chinese teacher was there, and I was hearing what a terrible time he had had during the war. And I said, well, I've got a very, very nice naval blanket. It's a bit buggy, but if you like it, you can have it. And I gave him that and one or two other things. And of course, I got back, got to the Hong Kong Hotel, the old Hong Kong Hotel where we were being billeted, and back to, again, no bed and no bedclothes. But it was an odd period that.
Now, can we go on to the work that you did in the rehabilitation of the colony after the liberation?
Yes, well, I went out, and we took over offices in the old Hong Kong Bank building. I said the old has been demolished and rebuilt now, but it was a very fine building. And that had been Japanese government offices. And for the first 4 or 5 days when I went in my... still wearing uniform, a bit tattered by this time, I might say. I was still in uniform. And there was still a Japanese sentry on duty at Ling, and I would get a very smart salute from him. My cook boy used to come and collect my washing every day, which was a G-string, which made out of a Hong Kong golf club scarf, and a Red Cross shirt. I had two shirts and two G-strings. And he used to take these religiously to be washed each day and bring them back. And then he would walk with me to the Hong Kong Bank building. And I'd say, you're going in the wrong direction. You live that way. Oh, he said, I come to see the Japanese century, salute you. And this was the case for the first 4 or 5 days. The Japanese were providing a lot of the policing. It was an odd setup, and they were very well disciplined. And I can't remember the number, certainly it was several days with the Japanese sentry. And anyway, we started the office. There was no paper, there was no ink, there was nothing. You know, there was no transport. Virtually every car in Hong Kong had been transported up to Japan. The trams weren't working. The only way you could get around was really on foot or riding pillion on a bicycle. A lot of young Chinese were very quick on the uptake, and they produced bicycles, and you could, or stand on the step of a bicycle, and you could get around like that. And it was a very, very interesting time. Rats everywhere. After about a week, 10 days, my boss, who was a military administration colonel, had arrived and did have transport, and went round with him, and all the roads, once you got away from central Hong Kong, all the roads were blocked with landslides. There'd been no attempt to try to clear them. It was just run down to nothing, and it's extraordinary. Until the last 6 months, I think the Japanese must have expected to win the war. And yet, as far as Hong Kong was concerned, they made no attempt to keep it going as a viable place. So anyway, we got our first lots of materials to work with from an aircraft carrier which was on its way to Okinawa with an RAF works unit. And they had quite a lot of material, particularly things like steel and concrete and cement and so on. And this was unloaded in Hong Kong. And so we were able to begin work. There was I used to attend a twice a week meeting with the my boss, who was a colonel, bracket civil affairs works, with the CRE, the Commander Royal Engineers, captain of the dockyard, and the RAF, I think he was the wing commander, and they'd have twice a week meetings to discuss how they could go about this rehabilitation of Hong Kong. And our job was mainly dealing with the civilian part, particularly hospitals, getting hospitals, clinics, so on, back to police stations, back to some sort of use, getting materials from where we could. But it worked very well as a sort of inter-service cooperation. It worked pretty well. And I left in November, middle of November, 45, and it was beginning to get something like, you know, the roads were usable again.
Where did you leave for?
UK, back to where my parents were still here, back to England.
Did your prisoner of war experience change your attitude towards the Japanese?
Yes, immediately, yes. And I've got the letters that I wrote to my parents immediately after the surrender. And also some letters I wrote in the prison camp. My father kept them. When he died, I decided I would keep them. And yes, one had awful hate against the Japanese. And though even in one or two of these letters, I did say they weren't all bad. But since then, I've been to Japan a couple of times. My son-in-law worked there, and my wife and I went to stay in Tokyo with them. And I have no hang-ups about the Japanese now. I think that war is war. I think we all behave badly under war conditions. And that, they weren't all bad. And I found in Tokyo they couldn't have been a more honest and more pleasant group of people than the Japanese I came across. Not socially, just using the underground as a visitor to Japan. There was they were extremely helpful.
Did your prisoner of war experience leave you with any long-term effects?
No. I think I don't think so. In the early days, when I got back here, I tended, and even in Hong Kong, everybody was nice to me and anything like that, I tended to cry. I think perhaps our nerves were far more affected than we realise. And I think it did me no harm to do this, stay on and do this work in Hong Kong. But I know when I got back to England, you know, I tended to be more. Well, I've never been a very weepy person, but I was very weepy the first few weeks when I got back to England, seeing my relatives and so. And I didn't want to socialise. I remember going to one or two parties, and I would drift out, and I think one had become very, very self-contained in the prison camp, and all one longed for was privacy. And this comes out in these letters that I wrote, both in the prison camp and afterwards, that it was the worst part of being in the prison camp was the lack of privacy. You know, 40 in a hut and no privacy at all, really. It's interesting anyway. You after any long-term effects. I would say, you know, until about 4 years ago, I broke my ankle and I had to go to hospital. And I went to Charing Cross Hospital. They were very, very good in the way they set my ankle and looked after me. But I had to be in for 3 weeks, which was quite a long time because of the wound. I went septic and they wouldn't let me out. And I was in a four-bedded ward and people would invade my bed space. I had a window, a bed by the window, and visitors would come and look out of the window. Well, in the prison camp, my bed space was mine. And I didn't go and sit on somebody else's bed without saying, may I sit on your bed? And people would invade my bed space. And there were little things that reminded me of the prison camp, but many things did. And I think they let me out. My septic wound was still not cured, but I think they realised that I was going to go around the bend if I stayed in the hospital any longer, and they let me out, and I had to have it dressed here once a day by a district nurse. But when I arrived back here, I simply burst into tears. And my brother came up to see me 3 or 4 days later. He came, and I burst into tears. I was really back again in the same sort of tensed up way I had been in the prison camp. It probably needs a psychologist to see if there was any connection, but certainly, as far as I'm concerned, it was very, very much the same feelings. And quite interesting.